members of the Commonwealth Club, distinguished guests and visitors, the speaker today is from Missouri. Since the lamented day, April 12th, that has taken on even more significance than it had before. And many, I'm told now, are trying to find Missouri connections, which our speaker has enjoyed for all these many years. He is the son of a country doctor, and that recommends him to us because we have some appreciation of the kind of human training that came out of life in a country doctor's home. He is a college professor, which of course gives him immunity from any responsibility or consequences for what he says. This makes an ideal setup for a Commonwealth Club luncheon talk. Dr. Hudson early demonstrated a wide interest and intellectual capacity. We find him in Missouri in 1910 writing a book about property laws, and shortly thereafter dealing with commercial laws, and within a very brief period a member of a commission, a Childs Commission, to codify laws with respect to them. And not long after, manifesting his interest in world affairs that has prevailed to this day. In 1912, Mr. Hudson was helpful in forming the American Peace Society. Then came the Versailles Treaty, service to the government in many aspects of international affairs, appointment to the law faculty of Harvard, which I suppose is something all university professors of law aspire to. Since that time, I've tried to find out whether he really is attached to Harvard or to Geneva or some other point in Europe, or whether he is just sort of a traveling troubleshooter for the United States. Whatever the facts are, I know that in this audience, Dr. Hudson, you have many old and valued friends. And it's a pleasure to us, first, to know that you're in San Francisco contributing so much from your rich experience and judgment, and next, to welcome you back as a friend of San Francisco and this community.
Mr. President, members of the Commonwealth Club, it is a very great pleasure for me to find myself once again in the bosom of the most celebrated luncheon club in North America. 21 years ago, I had the privilege of being your guest here when the subject of our discussion was, "Is the League dead?" In framing the subject, I had reference to the statement made by a distinguished senator of Massachusetts on the morning after President Harding's famous front porch speech at Marion, Ohio. I was bold enough to suggest on that occasion that the League of Nations was not dead in 1924. And I'm sure that the members of this club have followed with very great satisfaction the many excellent contributions made by the League of Nations in those interim years down to 1939. And if in that latter year the League of Nations failed to measure up to the hopes which you and I may have entertained, I think none of us is disposed to take satisfaction in the abstention of some of the great states of the world which made that failure inevitable. 2 years ago also, I had the privilege of being received by your International Relations Section. And at that time, I endeavored to outline my own approaches to the problem of international organization as it confronts us in these latter years. I endeavored to say, not for anyone else's guidance, but for my own, that it was necessary to keep in mind three things. First of all, that the world did not begin yesterday. Some of my friends today are prone to forget that fact. Secondly, that the world will not stand still tomorrow. And many of my friends seem to think as if that were not a self-evident proposition. And thirdly, that the road of international relations is not a one-way street, though many of my friends are disposed to discuss it in terms of the interests of a single country. For me, perhaps not for you, those approaches hold today. And I should like to address myself to the topic of this luncheon, the world caught today and tomorrow with those approaches in the back of my mind. All of us in this conference, and I think all of us in the United States, are disposed to pay at least lip service to justice and international law as the foundation of the new United Nations organization. I would suggest to you that it may be necessary for us to pay more than lip service to justice and international law in our planning for the future. An organized world has need of organized justice. And organized justice means that as disputes between peoples and between states will be inevitable, arrangements must be made for their pacific settlement. One or more tribunals must be created to which certain disputes, at any rate, may be brought for settlement. In approaching that problem, I would suggest, in line with my approach of a moment ago, that we must bear in mind that we live in a stream of history. And whatever one's feelings may be about the events of the past, I believe you will agree with me that it is impossible for us to take a battle axe to history. The history of organized international justice in modern times spans a period of only 150 years. Yet throughout that period, efforts, at any rate in the Western world, have been continuous. I say 150 years because we can trace this history from a treaty between the United States and Great Britain concluded in 1794, a treaty which we refer to in this country as the Jay Treaty. Under that instrument, three arbitrations were held between the United States and Great Britain. Two of them were attended with conspicuous success, with the result that a great impetus was given throughout the Western world to the development of arbitration law, to the conduct of arbitrations, and to treaties in advance providing for arbitrations. The 19th century saw many scores of successful arbitrations between states. The most conspicuous of them, perhaps, was the Geneva arbitration between the United States and Great Britain in 1872. It was natural, therefore, that toward the end of the century, a persistent movement existed in the Western world. Indeed, that movement may be traced back in the documents as far as 1838. A persistent movement existed, urging the establishment of a permanent international court, which should be open at all times for the arbitrament of international differences. And when a peace conference met at The Hague in 1899, it could not ignore the progress of that movement. That conference created the Permanent Court of Arbitration, a great institution which has existed now for 45 years. During the past 12 years, I have had the honor to be a member of the Permanent Court of Arbitration on two appointments by the President of the United States. Some 21 cases were referred to tribunals created within the framework of the Permanent court of arbitration. And although this conference has not emphasized the point, I think it may be put down that this institution will continue to exist in the future. However, the Permanent Court of Arbitration was not what its name implies. It was not really a court, and it was not permanent. It was not a court because its membership consists merely of a panel of men who may be called upon to constitute tribunals if states wish to create them. And even in 1899, public opinion in this and other countries was disposed to say that the Hague Conference of 1899 had not gone far enough in this direction. At a second peace conference at The Hague in 1907, an effort was made, therefore, to supplement the Permanent Court of Arbitration with a really permanent court consisting of a small number of judges who would devote all of their time to the task and who would be ready at any time to hear disputes between states. That effort in 1907, though supported by many prominent governments of the Western world, ended in failure. It ended in failure because of the insistence by large states as well as small that they should be represented by the judges on the bench. At the end of the last war, it was everywhere agreed that this long story should be taken up once more. And in 1920, we saw a successful effort made to achieve agreement on the statute of a really permanent court. I think December 16th, 1920, can go down in the history of international law as a red letter day. For on that day was finally achieved the agreement of many states on the statute of the Permanent Court of International Justice. May I take a few moments, therefore, to describe to you the results of that achievement. In the first place, in 1920, there was a complete reversal of the tendency which had wrecked the peace conference at The Hague in 1907. Large states, as well as small, abandoned their insistence on representation on the bench of the new court. And they provided for the election of a small number of judges, none of whom would represent any state, not even the state of which he might be a national. That, I think, was the greatest single bit of progress made in 1920. Under the statute of the court, the elections of the judges, a small number of judges, proceeded quite smoothly. It was provided that the election should be conducted by both the Council and the Assembly of the League of Nations. In the Assembly, each state member of the League of Nations had one vote. In the Council, only a few states were represented. That suggestion, which came partly from Mr. Elihu Root, enabled a solution to be found for the deadlock of 1907. With the election of judges first accomplished in 1921, the court opened its doors at The Hague in January of 1922. And I am happy to say that it kept its doors open at The Hague until they were closed by a stern invader in May of 1940. Not only did many states join in the election of the judges, some of them not members of the League of Nations, but practically all of the states of the world proceeded to confer jurisdiction on the new court. The statute of the court was merely constitutive. It constituted and set up the court without conferring upon it any particular jurisdiction. But it included an optional clause, states remaining free to exercise or not to exercise the option as they pleased, conferring on the court a compulsory or obligatory jurisdiction over certain classes of legal disputes. Well, progress under that optional clause was slow for a while, but I am glad to say that within a few years, 45 of the 51 states which became parties to the statute of the court accepted the obligatory jurisdiction of the court. And in a number of cases, in some of which I myself sat as a judge, for I was elected a judge by the suffrage of 53 nations in 1936, in a number of cases, the court exercised that obligatory jurisdiction. Not only that, but in a very large number of treaties, perhaps 500 in all, states conferred on the court a jurisdiction to deal with disputes which might arise under those treaties. We came to have, therefore, a large body of law looking to the court as the center for the realization of its purposes. And I think the court deserved the name of World Court because practically all of the states of the world, all indeed, except Nepal, Saudi Arabia, Vatican City State, and Yemen, participated in the movement which I have described and conferred some measure of jurisdiction on the court. Now, what was the record of the Permanent Court in dealing with the 65 or more cases which came before it? In the first place, it worked out a generally satisfactory procedure. And on no occasion did the states which were parties to those 65 or more cases ever make any objection to the court's procedure that was being followed. The result was that in a number of cases, the court was able to establish in its jurisprudence a new repository of the principles of international law to guide our time. Perhaps you would be interested if I take a moment to refer to two of the more striking cases which came before the Permanent Court. The first was a case concerning the sovereignty over Eastern Greenland, in dispute for many years between Norway and Denmark. And finally, to end that dispute, Norway clamped down a royal proclamation annexing the disputed territory. Within 2 days, both Denmark and Norway, bound by the compulsory or obligatory jurisdiction of the court, appeared at The Hague and asked the court to pronounce upon that legal situation. The case was long and drawn out. Most international cases are. It took 2.5 years to get the case prepared, to conduct the hearings, and for the court to proceed to judgment. The hearings alone, the oral hearings alone, consumed 57 half-day sessions of the court. And then the court pronounced its judgment in favor of Denmark. And those of us who follow these matters were interested to know what Norway would do. Within 2 days, Norway withdrew her royal proclamation annexing the disputed territory. A second case to which I may refer was a case between France, a powerful state of Europe, and Switzerland, a small state of Europe, concerning the free zones which surround the canton of Geneva. The French government, relying upon a provision in the Treaty of Versailles, suddenly decided about 1922 to put an end to those zones which had existed for more than 100 years. Consternation prevailed among a part of the Swiss population. And after protracted discussions, France and Switzerland entered into an agreement to refer that situation to the court at The Hague. The case again was long drawn out. It took several years, and the court had to try out various tentatives of solution before it finally gave a judgment in favor of the small state of Switzerland. In that judgment, it declared that the customs frontier of France should be removed from the political frontier and placed back at the head of the zones by midnight of a certain day in February 1935. It was a very bold action to be taken by a court. And those of us who follow these matters sat on the edges of our chairs to see what a powerful state of Europe was to say in response to the court's order in behalf of a small state of Europe. At 10 o'clock on the evening before the day appointed, France withdrew her last custom station from the political frontier. Those are merely two cases which I thought I would refer to only for the sake of being concrete and enabling you to know what type of question a world court may have to deal with. On the record as a whole, I think, and I hope Judge Delgado will bear me out, that lawyers throughout the world are disposed to take very great satisfaction. This court, the Permanent Court of International Justice, still exists. During these hard years, the president of the court and the registrar have remained at their posts in Geneva, having removed from The Hague. The judges of the court have stuck by during these hard years, and they have sacrificed a financial advantage, many of them, not including myself, by failing to resign and by asserting their loyalty to an existing institution which personifies so many of the hopes of mankind. Moreover, even during these hard years, the states, members of the League of Nations, have continued to aliment a small budget for the court. And the court is living this year on that budget. So much for the world court today. What now shall I say of the world court of tomorrow? Well, some of you might have thought it, as I did, a natural thing to anticipate that one of the most successful, if not the most successful, international institution of our time would be continued as in relation to the new United Nations organization. A decision has been taken at this conference, however, that is not to be the case. We shall not continue as an institution the Permanent Court of International Justice. There has been no criticism of the court during this conference, so far as I know, and I think Judge Delgado agrees with me. There has been no criticism of the court. There has been no dissatisfaction expressed with its record. There has been no objection advanced to the procedure which it adopted and followed. But for reasons unrelated to the replace the Permanent Court of International Justice, that decision will at any rate have the very great advantage of being supported by the United States of America, which during all these years has never given any support to the court, the Permanent Court of International Justice, has never used it in any single case, and has never paid one red penny for its expenses. We are to have then, in the future, a new court. First of all, it will have a new name. It will not be called the Permanent Court of International Justice. It will be called the International Court of Justice. You may be able to find some advantages in that changed phraseology. I believe I'm told that in Turkey, in the outlying districts, the people have a habit. If a child gets very sick and his life is despaired of, they think it may do some good to change the child's name. They proceed to do so. This conference, without dealing even with a sick patient, has changed the name. In the second place, the new court, unlike the old, will be the principal organ of the new international organization. There's always, as the President was saying to me a few moments ago, a bit of irony in history. the United States, in many quarters in this country, we had objection made to our support of the Permanent Court of International Justice because in an attenuated way, it was somehow related to the League of Nations. That was felt to be a great weakness of a judicial institution. Now, we say, the judicial institution must be the principal judicial organ of the new international organization. In the third place, the new court will take over, almost intact, the statute of the Permanent Court of International Justice. Even the numbering of the articles will be kept. The seat of the new court, like the seat of the old, will be at The Hague, where we have the magnificent Peace Palace built by Andrew Carnegie just before the World War of 1914. I don't know, perhaps you will think that it is bad luck for the world to create any palace for the institutions of peace. The Peace Palace at The Hague was barely opened a few days before the war of 1914. And the magnificent buildings of the League of Nations at Geneva were opened only a few months before war broke out in 1939. Maybe the moral is that every international institution should be housed in very humble quarters. The organization of the new court will follow in its broad lines and in many details the organization of the old court. The election of judges will be by the same method, substituting the General Assembly and the Security Council for the Assembly and the Council of the League of Nations. The procedure of the court will continue as before. In other words, the Permanent Court of International Justice made such a success of its procedure, Judge Delgado, that you even didn't dare to propose a change of detail. What about the jurisdiction of the new court? Well, that question is sub judice at this moment. Judge Delgado may decide it this afternoon, or he may wait until tomorrow morning. In view of that fact, perhaps I, as a representative of the Permanent Court of International Justice, should not speak out in true Missouri fashion. There is strong support here, as you know from the newspapers, for conferring on the court, new court, an obligatory jurisdiction over legal disputes. In other words, there is strong support for converting the present optional clause into a binding, compulsory, obligatory clause for all states. On the other hand, some states seem to feel that it is not possible for them to go that far. And I think you will agree with me that the object of an international conference is not to compel states to do something, but to achieve agreement among them to the extent possible. My tutor in these matters, Mr. Elihu Root, was continually saying to me, leg over leg, the dog went to Dover. And if the decision shall be to continue the present optional clause, I think we may expect progress under it. What I would point out is that in the new court, we shall have a continuity of the history which I have endeavored to trace. And if Judge Delgado will permit me to do so, I will say that the new court will be in some measure a successor to the old court. Of course, your interest and mine transcends the claims of any particular institution. What you and I are interested in is a viable judicial process in international affairs. And I think we can say that that process will go on in the future. The whole world is agreed today on the essentials of the judicial process. A notice to each state concerned in a dispute, an opportunity for each state to appear and to present its contentions, a deliberation by carefully trained, selected judges on the contentions presented, and finally, a judgment of those judges confined to the actual issues of a particular case. On those points, there is no disagreement among lawyers in any part of the world. Nor is there disagreement that we have today a great body of international law, far more than many people realize, to be applied by an international court. We do not have a code of international law, it is true, but we have a large number of treaties, some of them great world treaties, in force between states. A competent man a few years ago estimated, that as many as 15,000 treaties were actually in force among states at that moment. We not only have a process on the essentials of which we all agree, we have a law existing which a court can apply. With that brief description of the new court, I hope that you will agree with me that the outlook today is far from discouraging. I think we may anticipate that this continuous history of 150 years will continue to yield its fruits to our generation. We may anticipate a development and a strengthening of the judicial process. And if it is to accomplish the ends which you and I have in view, it will obviously be necessary for it to be understood and supported by intelligent people everywhere.